From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The holidays can be a difficult time, especially for people who spend them alone. A few weeks ago, we talked about the emotional experience of loneliness. Well, today, we're looking at the health effects of sustained loneliness with Kirsten Emerson. She's a clinical assistant professor of gerontology at UGA's College of Public Health, and she's joining us via Skype. Kirsten, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So loneliness and being alone, not the same thing. Can you clear up the distinction for us?
That's a really good way to start to talk about this topic, because you can be alone and not be lonely. You can also be with lots of people and still feel lonely. So loneliness is very much the subjective feeling of your needs being met. Some of us have a high need for social interaction and some of us don't. And so it's very much about your own needs and if they're being met.
So by self-reporting, 1 in 3 or 1 in 2, depending on which research you look at, report feeling lonely in America. Some public health officials are calling loneliness an epidemic. So what are some measurable health effects?
That's a good question. So we never really thought about the fact that loneliness could be more than just a quality of life issue. But in the last few decades, we've really noticed that there are physical health outcomes. So loneliness has been linked to all sorts of things like disability rates, early entrance into nursing homes, going to see your doctor more often. But also recently, researchers found that it can actually kill you, where you are more likely to die early if you're lonely than those who aren't.
So what are some of the particular physiological effects?
So there's different ways to look at it. One is if you're social, you're more likely to have healthier behaviors, right? If you're hanging out with friends, maybe they'll invite you to go for a walk and you're going to go for longer exercise periods than if you do it by yourself. Or you may go to a lunch and dinner and have a healthier choice than maybe just pouring yourself a bowl of cereal at night because you don't want to be bothered to make a whole large dinner. So there's that. But there's also very genetic kind of biological relationships between loneliness and health outcomes. So we're kind of programmed to want to be social because that helps us survive. And when we're not doing that, even our immune system can be compromised. So you may actually just be more susceptible to colds and getting sicker, which then, of course, can lead you to stay home more often and then not be as socially engaged. So it can be kind of a vicious cycle.
I'm looking at long-term effects of loneliness compared to the effects of smoking 15 cigarettes per day or alcoholism in some cases. You, Kirsten, researched the elderly population. How does loneliness affect seniors in particular?
So for older adults, it's a particular issue because some of the life events that can sometimes be higher risk categories for loneliness are more likely to happen among older adults. So one of them is retirement. Maybe your social engagement was being met by going to work every day, but now you're retired and you may not have an outlet for your social interaction outside of work. Or stopping to drive for older adults can be a major one. If you can't drive yourself anymore, in many places in America where you live, you might not be able to get out and do the things that you used to do, like going to clubs or going to church. If you can't drive, you may just physically become socially isolated, even if you'd really like to be out and about. Another one for older adults that's common is physical or mental health issues. So if you have some physical health problems that prevent you from going out, or if you're on more medications that make you dizzy and maybe a little more weary about going out, then you might start to isolate yourself, and then your needs are not being met as much.
But this is not by any means the only population. In fact, according to a report this fall out from Cigna, Generation Z is the loneliest generation. So these are people born in the mid-1990s to early 2000. What in particular is making them feel so lonely?
Yes, it's interesting because one of the interesting things about loneliness is it just doesn't discriminate. It can happen to anyone at any age. And in part, you know, we often like to blame social media, but I do think there's a relationship there that we sometimes think social media can replace social contacts, but it really can't. It can help. So, you know, I look at older adults, but for other people as well, especially if they're homebound, being able to connect with people via, you know, Skype like we're doing today, or looking at Facebook and connecting with old friends can be really great, but can also be really negative for you. So what if you, especially this time of year, log into your Facebook account or whatever social media is cooler than that now? You see people having fun and being with friends and family, and you don't have that. That can actually make you start to become or to feel like maybe your needs aren't being met because your expectations are going to go up seeing how other people are engaging. And so I think that can happen for any age group.
Well, so you pointed out in your research that loneliness and social isolation are often overlooked. So who is it that isn't paying attention? Is it the public? Is it medical professionals? Is it friends and family?
Yeah, I think it's actually all of them. So what's interesting is, and you just mentioned this earlier, right? It's connected. It's worse for your health than smoking or obesity. It's actually twice as harmful as obesity, but we don't have any public health campaigns for loneliness. We have a lot for obesity and smoking. And obviously those are incredibly important. And I'm not saying we shouldn't have those, but when was the last time you saw a billboard that talks about loneliness or having a small community outreach about loneliness? That isn't really happening. And in part, it's because we think of it as an isolated problem, but it's really a national crisis, I would say. If one out of three, or some research even more than that, are experiencing loneliness, then this is actually a big deal, especially because it can have these physical health consequences and it can even kill you early. And in some of our research, we found that older adults are seeing their doctor more often. And it's interesting because that's when people started to pay attention to our research, is when they realized that there's some economic cost to it.
Yeah.
Because it's really expensive to see a doctor.
Well, let's dig into that a little. You studied hospitalization and physician visits. And one of your studies in the American Journal of Public Health kind of pulled that apart. Can you tell us a little bit more about this study on healthcare utilization by people who are feeling lonely? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the study came about because I would talk to physicians who were not geriatricians, so they did not specialize in aging, but they would tell me that they saw older adults all the time in their practice and how frustrated they would be because they didn't actually think there was much wrong with many of them. They were coming in to talk. And so being the nerdy researcher that I am, we decided to look at it with data, and the data really supports this. And we found that older adults controlling for all sorts of health conditions were more likely to see a doctor if they were lonely, and they were more likely to see their primary care physician. And in a lot of ways, that makes sense because a lot of times you know your primary care physician, you know the office staff at the front. It becomes a place where you can socialize. We didn't find that relationship with emergency room visits, which again also kind of makes sense. An ER is not a place where you usually know the people working. It's often also not a particularly pleasant place to be, and you don't really get a lot of socialization. Whereas in your primary care physician's office, you may get quite a bit of it. You talk to the front office staff, you talk to your doctor. It becomes more of a social event.
Nearly half of Americans report feeling lonely. That's according to a Cigna study, and some experts have called loneliness an epidemic. Kirsten Emerson studies loneliness as a public health issue. She's at UGA, and she's a clinical assistant professor of gerontology in the College of Public Health. I want to pick up on that because we heard a piece last week on NPR that Greeley, Colorado, this is a fire department small town, has a dedicated new specialized squad to respond to 911 calls. This is for non-emergencies. And the crew includes mental health professionals. Here's Jamie Clapp, a therapist in Colorado, evaluating a call.
I'm assessing his loneliness and if he's had contacts, because that can lead to a lot of physical problems. And we want to get him help and care, but we also care about him. And we want to make sure that he doesn't lose contact with somebody.
So she was talking there about a repeat 911 caller. How does this illuminate the need for resources? And do you know of any other community resources for people who are lonely and who need assistance?
Yes, this is one of those times where people, again, start to pay attention because we're not using our tools effectively. And often it can be really expensive to use things like 911 for non-emergency calls. And neighborhoods and communities have actually been grappling with this problem for decades. And many small communities and even some larger ones have really great programs like this in place, where repeat callers get put on call lists or even visit lists by volunteers, which can be really great. And I think communities are already doing a really good job of at least trying to work with this population. What I think we're not so great about yet is doing almost a national level policy intervention. And other countries have done this. So for instance, the UK has this really wonderful program called the Silver Line, which has, among many things, a 1-800 or whatever the UK equivalent is, a toll-free number where older adults can call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And that can, you know, reroute those 911 calls, which is not an effective use of our resources, into a place where there are trained volunteers that talk to them. They can be social calls. They can also do referrals if they need to, you know, maybe have some mental health counseling or some other things. But in many ways, it's just a place to call. And they've actually found in the UK that most of their calls are in the evenings or at nighttime when all the other places are closed. So there's clearly a huge need for it, which we don't yet have in the United States, though I do think communities like this one are doing a really good job trying to, with their limited resources, trying to come up with programs like that.
That's when people call. Sometimes loneliness has an isolating effect. We spoke this month with the host of the Lonely Hour podcast about the shame and stigma of loneliness, even though, you know, so many feel lonely. So what are some of the signs that somebody might be feeling loneliness?
Well, someone especially who used to have a really active life who may no longer be as active socially, that's something to look out for. So I mentioned driving earlier is a really big one for older adults. Maybe they were super active and they would drive themselves to places, but now for whatever reason, they can't drive anymore. That's a really big warning sign if you see that happening, to make sure that they still get maybe some in-home socialization. So maybe some phone calls could be warranted. And, you know, we often think about our own grandparents, and that's a pretty good place to start. But in our own neighborhoods, there's often people that we think, you know, that person probably doesn't have a lot of people to talk to. So just knowing that homebound is a pretty good risk factor, but also thinking about some of the life changes that may contribute to people not being as social as they used to be. And the reason I say that is because, as we talked about at the beginning, it's so subjective. I don't know if you're lonely just from looking at you. I can't draw your blood, which I know is part of what's frustrating to physicians. They don't know if someone's lonely. But if you know some of the risk factors, like a change in their social activity, you can at least be on the alert that they may be feeling lonely.
There's a lot of research indicating that the holidays can be an especially difficult time emotionally. There's a lot of stress, often unrealistic expectations of togetherness and perfection. But there is this myth that suicides go up around the December holidays. Data does not back that up. Suicides actually decrease at this time of year. What do you think it is that perpetuates this idea?
Yes. And so part of the word that you used that was important here is expectations, right? And this is part of loneliness too. If your expectations are really high and are not being met, then you're lonely. But I think what we're actually much more concerned about is this chronic or persistent loneliness, being lonely every now and then, or just being bummed when you see other people having more of a social life than you are, especially around the holidays. That's a normal range of human emotion. That's okay if you feel it for a couple of days, even maybe for a week or two around special holidays. But that's not usually where the physical and mental health outcomes are. It's usually the people who are chronically and persistently lonely or persistently have depression. So the range of human emotions, totally normal if it's just up and down for a couple of days. But if it's persistent for sometimes years and years, that's really when we start seeing these health outcomes.
So if somebody is listening to this interview and feels either is going to be alone or just feels alone over the holidays, having trouble coping with the stress, what is your advice?
That's a good question, right? It's so difficult because of the word that you mentioned earlier, stigma. A lot of people don't want to admit to being lonely. And so kind of as trite as it sounds, it's really important to just admit that you need some more interaction. So reaching out. There are many programs that are wonderful in many communities that you can reach out to. There's, you know, especially for older adults, area agencies on aging, but there's lots of things that are happening. But it is kind of the pressure is on the person to reach out themselves, because many times others won't know that you're lonely because you can't see it. And so they may not know to reach out to them. And so my first, you know, piece of advice is always to just admit to it. You know that you're not the only one. You're not lonely in your loneliness, per se. You're not the only one. So admit it and just reach out to people. And it's okay to do. Most people will understand it. We've all been there at some point or another. And if the research is accurate, most people around you are also feeling lonely, so they may actually appreciate you reaching out.
Kirsten Emerson, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Kirsten Emerson is Clinical Assistant Professor of Gerontology in UGA's College of Public Health. Now, just ahead, the GPB Newsroom has had a really full year. We're going to be hearing from some reporters and hosts about the stories and projects that really stuck with them from 2018. That's when On Second Thought continues after a short break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is that time of year when we look back and reflect on some of our newsroom's proudest moments. We're not going to run down the year in news, but we're asking some members of the GPB family about their favorite projects of the year. Cindy Hill hosts All Things Considered for stations based outside of Atlanta, and she's also the Savannah station manager. Hello, Cindy.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also joining us is GPB politics reporter Stephen Fowler. Hello, Stephen.
Happy to be here.
Well, great to have you with us. Now, Cindy, I want to start with you. Since we're both interviews, The rule is we don't bury the lead. So let's start with a very intriguing story. This is space rockets. Apparently, Georgia might start launching them soon. Is that true?
Absolutely. So a few years ago, NASA declassified documents that showed that Camden County, which is the southernmost county on Georgia's coast, was actually considered by NASA to be the potential launch site for the Apollo rocket program. And that site, of course, later turned into what's today Cape Canaveral in Florida. In 2017, the General Assembly and Governor Deal passed measures to support the industry, and they saw this as a chance for economic development in the area. Camden County is home to Kings Bay Naval Submarine Base. It's the biggest economic driver in the county. But honestly, there's not that much there other than that. So they saw this as a potential way to boost the economy. Camden County also happens to be home to probably Georgia's most famous barrier island, Cumberland Island. It's the southernmost island. It's the largest barrier island, and it's part of the National Park Service, Cumberland Island National Seashore. It's one of the largest maritime forests in the U.S., home to wild horses, migratory birds, sea turtles, feral hogs, tons of snakes, and it's protected. And so the rub, the kind of intersection here, is that the proposed launch site for the rockets is over Cumberland Island, including private homes that are on the island and on Little Cumberland Island, which is nearby, as well as homes that are on the mainland. And so there's this kind of battle of economic development versus environmental preservation.
So the last time you followed up on this story, this was in late September, and that is when the Coast Guard accepted public comments on the spaceport. Here is some audio from the opposing side. Let's hear that first.
I always say, think of Georgia, don't just think of peaches and think of space. So we have a great opportunity to take all these assets that Georgia has, leverage it, and really build for the future.
Think about over a 10-year period, the cumulative effect of all that aerospace-grade aluminum and composite and being blown to bits all over our marshes and the Cumberland River, and you can't clean that up.
Cindy, can you expand on that pro-con views?
Absolutely. Yeah, the first person that you heard is Steve Howard. He's the county administrator for Camden County, and he's also the principal on the spaceport. And he's kind of been the driving figure behind this, but he represents what a lot of people think, which is that they need jobs, they need economic development in the area, they need to expand economic development, because so much of their economy relies on the Naval Submarine Base. And as all communities who have military bases know, that could change. Government funding is one of those things you can't always count on. And so they're looking to the future. They kind of have an idea of build it and they will come in terms of rocket, luring rocket companies there. The second voice you heard was Kevin Lang. He's an Athens attorney whose family has a house on Little Cumberland Island. And they have, even before Cumberland Island National Seashore was protected, Little Cumberland has extreme protections in terms of the environment. You can't build big houses. In fact, their houses it's a little like Swiss Family Robinson, honestly. It's not like a private island that you think of, maybe Jekyll Island. They're small houses. They all have to live very responsibly on the land. If you need anything on either of these islands, you have to bring it over on a ferry. You have to bring it with you. And they want to preserve this. They find they have kind of a mission about themselves to preserve this very special environment. The waters around these islands is where right whales are calving right now, literally, and where sea turtles come to lay their nests. So both sides have really compelling arguments.
And such a story with so many layers and a lot of depth.
Absolutely.
And I really appreciate this context. And that was in September when you reported there. Have there been any updates from officials or local residents on the process?
So right now, they're waiting to hear back from two federal agencies, the Federal Aviation Administration and the Coast Guard. The spaceport has to be approved by both of those entities to move forward. They need a rocket launch license from the FAA, and they filed that in March. The FAA came down to Camden County and hosted a couple of public forums, and so that's where we started hearing people talking on both sides of the issue. And then the Coast Guard opened it up earlier this year because up to 12 times a year when they have rocket launches, they'll need to close the waters under the proposed rocket launch site. So that means people who are recreational boaters, fishers, shrimpers, as well as the ferries that carry people on and off of the islands can't run during those times. So again, it's a really complicated issue. There are really good people on both sides of this, and it's really kind of pitting economic preservation, environmental preservation versus economic development.
Well, that is often the fight. But it's different in particular in its own way for every one of those fights. And I'm wondering for the GPB listener who hears stories like this one every day but doesn't really know how they come together from the pitch of the idea to the web post. Can you talk us through how you put this one together or one of your stories related to the proposed spaceport?
Sure. This one was actually really this required a lot of field trips, which, you know, is a lot of fun. So I went down to Camden County for those FAA meetings and got to meet so many wonderful people who live in Camden County. Like I said, on both sides of the issues, people who have been hunting on that land for years and who see this as a great economic opportunity. There's actually a retired launch commander from Cape Canaveral who happened to retire in Camden County, completely unrelated to the spaceport. So, yeah. So you get to meet all these really interesting people with very different perspectives. Little Cumberland Island is the private island. I was invited over by some folks who live there just to kind of see. I had been to Cumberland Island many times. I grew up in Georgia and kind of you go there as a student and all that kind of stuff. So I knew how special that was. But Little Cumberland, to see this, you know, ancient lighthouse that guided boats to Georgia for years, to be on land that where James Oglethorpe, the founder of Georgia, literally had a house. You know, that's a deep thing to experience, and to have people invite you into their houses, to open up to you about their concerns, about their dreams for the future. It's an amazing thing to get to go to these places, be invited into these places, and to have people really open up. And we do that every day. We're so fortunate here in Georgia to have so many wonderful communities, and people really are willing to talk to us. And we loved hearing their stories, and we love presenting their stories to the public so that, like you mentioned, the listeners can get a sense of what's going on. It may resonate with somebody about something that's going on in their own community, or maybe they, you know, have been down to Camden County and have, you know, an idea about that. Maybe their kid wants to be a rocket engineer and they'd love to keep them in the state of Georgia, you know, instead of having them flee to Florida or to California, where so many rockets are being made and launched.
Well, one of the communities that you and Grant Blankenship, who's based in Macon, really illuminated for me was this Five Gullah Geechee features this year. Here's just a little bit from a story that you did earlier this year.
And I saw this tombstone, Jane Cummings Scott, 87 years old, died 1943. You know, I said, oh my, she was born in 1857. That was during years of slavery. And so that just opened up a whole world of doing genealogy and listening more carefully to the stories that I'd been hearing all these years.
That was Patricia West, a writer and professor at Savannah State University, and she was inspired to document her family's roots after discovering her great-great-grandmother's grave on a trip to the family cemetery. So, Cindy, what did you learn that you didn't know already when researching for these features? Because you've spent a lot of time down there in the Gullah Geechee land.
I have, and I grew up in Georgia, but I've got to tell you, this history was not taught when I was in school. I went to public schools in Macon. I had a fantastic education, but this was not taught. And so I've, as an adult, have come to these stories and tried to educate myself. But for this story, for this series we did earlier this year, Grant and I were invited again into families who are working to preserve Gullah Geechee heritage, the culture. We went out with a father and son who are fifth generation and sixth generation oyster catchers here on the coast. And that's been their family's livelihood since they were brought here as enslaved people. And they are keeping that alive. And in fact, they're bringing Georgia oysters. They're helping to recultivate Georgia oysters and bring them back to restaurants. They're being served in restaurants now. Dr. West, invited me, she and her family invited me actually to the Cummingsville Cemetery, where that ancestor she was speaking of is buried. And it's on the banks of the Savannah River, on the South Carolina side of the Savannah River. And they had this libation ceremony. It's a ceremony to honor the known and unknown descendants of the ones who survived. They're the descendants of the ones who survived the passage from West Africa to the Americas when they came over as enslaved people. And to be part of this, to just be a fly on the wall as as these people honor their ancestors whose names we don't necessarily know, whose stories we don't necessarily know because they weren't documented or the documentation's been lost over time. It still gives me chills just to hear that quote. It's the most meaningful work that we do, I've got it, in my opinion. These little stories, these stories of individual people honoring their history and bringing it forward so we can all understand this place where we live and the traditions that were brought over by people whose lives we really don't know that much about.
Well, Cindy Hill, GBB host and station manager in Savannah, I'm going to move on to GBB's Stephen Fowler because he's here in the studio with us. And Stephen, this was the year that you transitioned from producing All Things Considered for GBB to reporting on politics for us. And of course, the Georgia governor's race, huge national story. You helped bring that story to a national public radio audience. For instance, you filed a story for Here and Now about Democrats in Georgia's midterms. Here's just a little clip from the interview that you got from executive director of the Democratic Party.
We are organizing in areas that we've never been in. We are doubling down in areas where we know there are more votes. We are knocking on more doors. We are making more calls. We are sending more texts. We are having more volunteers coming out and putting their blood, sweat, and tears into this campaign than we ever have before.
So, Stephen, a person listening to On Second Thought maybe heard a whole lot of reporting about the governor's race earlier this year. And that person has heard the stories. So take us behind that. What kind of knowledge did you gain about the electoral process just by covering it in person for so many months?
Well, Virginia, the first thing really is that as a journalist, you can't tell a story about something or tell it well unless you understand it yourself. So, you know, in the process of reporting these stories and finding things, I thought, first off, what do I not know about how things work? And it turned out the answer was a lot. You know, I don't have decades of experience covering government and politics and things. And so I use that to my advantage in these stories of figuring out, well, you know, if I don't know what something is and how it works and I'm supposed to be the one covering it, then certainly people in Georgia and across the state and across the country wouldn't know these things. And so, you know, that kind of guided the process of my storytelling and reporting and writing is figuring out, you know, what do I know? What do I need to know? And then how can I make sure that everyone else knows it? And so, you know, basically every single part of Georgia's election system has been sued this year in this election cycle. And so as understanding part of that, I've, you know, learned a lot more about how Georgia's elections work, maybe how they don't quite work. And, different ways it can be affected by lawsuits or people or, you know, somebody not showing up to work on election day or something like that.
Well, this is a big reporting challenge as well, because as we know, super contentious, partisan kind of politics at play, many accusations of voter disenfranchisement by that one particular party, you know, the Secretary of State's office represented by Brian Kemp against Stacey Abrams. And I'm wondering about how you navigate that, because I found that many of the guests that I speak to, they speak as if they make the assumption that it's true or it's not true. So how do you kind of steer clear of that? I mean, we know people get death threats if they say something against Donald Trump. What do you do in this atmosphere?
Well, so, you know, oftentimes, you know, somebody has, you know, maybe one party has one idea of how something is and another party has a different idea. And the truth is often somewhere in between the two. And so it's my job to kind of say, these are the facts, this is the context. And then hopefully, you know, I'm not in the business of trying to sway people's minds in one way or another with a story and reporting, but hopefully just by illuminating how something works and how it got there and how it could be changed, you know, people can get a better understanding of what it is, whether it's how absentee ballots work, what the pending list is, or just, you know, why does Fulton County take so dang long to count the votes on election night?
Right. Well, you've definitely expanded my awareness of that. But I'm going to switch gears for one second because this was such a beautiful piece that you put together. We've lost several notable figures this year, Senator John McCain, President George H.W. Bush, and the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. And you produced an Aretha Franklin piece with Chuck Reese. He is host of GPB's Bitter Southerner podcast. Let's hear just a little bit of that.
For 20 more years, she consistently put singles at number one on the charts, making us dance, sway, even cry.
Daydreaming and I'm thinking of you.
For those of us who grew up on soul music, these and many other songs are landmarks, caches in which we hide our own memories, touchstones we all go back to repeatedly because they inspire us, comfort us, make us dance as we did in our youth. No voice ever dominated a genre of music as completely as Aretha's.
Whoa, I just got little goosebumps. That was beautiful. That was one of the last things you produced for All Things Considered. Why does it stand out to you?
Well, you know, when I'm not covering politics or sleeping because of covering politics and things, you know, I'm a musician and I've always been a musician, and the power of music and sound is partly what drew me to working in public radio, is conveying that sound and the melodies and things. And the day after Aretha Franklin passed, Chuck Reese wrote this piece about Aretha Franklin, and our CEO, Taya Ryan, sent it to everyone and said, "You should read this. This is great." We agreed. It was great. And so I called Chuck and had him come in and read it, and he had mentioned so many songs and so many pieces there, and we're a radio station, there's sound, there's music, and so I put Chuck's words with Aretha's music to create this 10-minute just soundscape about Aretha Franklin in a way that not everybody else would cover, about her life or death or things, that made it uniquely Southern and uniquely musical, and that just spoke to me in so many ways.
Well, it spoke to all of us. Thank you so much. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
GPB reporter Stephen Fowler, also Cindy Hill from GPB. Now, up next, we're going to continue to learn from GPB reporters and correspondents about their proudest moments of 2018. And of course, leave you with some respect. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. As 2018 draws to a close, we're asking GPB reporters and correspondents about some of their favorite projects of the year. GPB senior anchor and special correspondent Ricky Bevington is here in this studio right now. Hello.
Hi there.
Nice to have you with us in the morning. GPB reporter Ross Terrell is also here. Hello, Ross.
Hey, how's it going?
And reporter and Morning Edition host Emily Jones is joining us from Savannah. Good morning.
Hey, Virginia.
Hey, how are you?
Great.
Thank you all for being here. And I want to start with Ricky with this series that you did this summer called What's in a Name. Now, what is What's in a Name?
What's in a Name is a series of stories about how Atlanta and Georgia places got their names. This was very much audience driven. So I invited audience members to submit crazy names, and we would do the research, and then we would tell stories about how different places got their names.
And what was your process for researching the names?
It could be everything from calling a local historical society. One of my interns drove down to the Auburn Avenue Research Library because the information was so old it wasn't online yet. He had to go through actual books. We actually had a lot of audience members help us answer the questions as well. So it was a multi-strategy.
Well, one of the names that you and your team researched is Bankhead. Here's the story behind that Atlanta neighborhood. I was born up in Bankhead. Y'all remember me? You love the way we claim in Bankhead. Thank you. I'm starting to see
spaceships on Bankhead. But you might not know that Bankhead gets its name from a cross-country highway that runs right through the middle of the community. The Bankhead Highway was an early 20th century auto trail back in the earliest days of automobiles.
So, Bankhead, who knew?
Who knew? In fact, one big inspiration for this project was that Atlanta musicians love to sing about Atlanta places. Of course, there's, as we just heard, there's a lot of urban musicians who sing about Bankhead. But we had a disco song about Buttermilk Bottom. We hear, of course, in Outkast songs, a lot of call-outs to just neighborhoods. And we drew a lot of inspiration from Atlanta music. Even the country song Dog River Blues by Georgia's own Alan Jackson is about an actual place called Dog River.
I think we need to hear just a little bit of Buttermilk Bottom because it was just off the chain.
Everybody's ducking and dodging down here in Buttermilk
So, you know, for me, I loved the series. I had just moved here, and it made me feel like a little bit of an insider. But you know Atlanta well. Were there any big surprises for you in this series?
I think the big surprises were some of the urban legends that some of these names come from. So let's take Panthersville. The legend is that the early settlers of Panthersville were chased by a panther. I have a lot of trouble believing the details of this urban legend.
Were you able to fact check that?
We can't fact check that. So a lot of the quote unquote historical accounts seemed like just tales that people told themselves. And so those end up becoming part of the real history.
Well, the response was great from listeners. Would you like to do a project like this again?
Absolutely. I think that Georgia has great names all over the state. And really, it's something we could do every year. And I think people would never really get tired of it.
All right, Emily, let's talk with you about your story on Savannah's historic landmark district designation. Earlier this year, the National Park Service recommended downgrading the city's status to threatened. So what does that actually mean?
So that's sort of like a status check on like how the historic landmark district is doing, basically. There was a bit of confusion when that recommendation first came out. People thought we were going to lose the landmark designation. That hasn't happened. That's doesn't look like that's a possibility, but it's kind of like an endangered species, like how species can be sort of at different levels of being threatened or endangered. You know, they took a look at Savannah's historic district and how things are going there. And they said, you know what, like this place could be at risk if, you know, if things don't change, if we keep on the path that we're on, you know, of we could be at risk of damaging the historic integrity. That's the whole reason that it is a National Historic Landmark.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of your feature on this issue.
Probably the best way to experience Savannah is the way a lot of locals and tourists do, on foot.
So welcome to Savannah. I'm Bonnie.
Our tour guide, Bonnie Terrell, tells us that to understand Savannah, you have to understand James Edward Oglethorpe, who founded the Georgia colony and designed this city.
He planned the usage of all the space in the city. He was very meticulous, even down to the use of the lots and the width of the streets.
The streets run in a grid, broken up by open space with grass, walkways, and fountains. Locals call them squares. A mix of public buildings and homes surround the squares, with alleys known as lanes running behind.
So even the lanes are part of our original plan. Sadly, they've been built over in various places.
And that is where the trouble comes in. A substantial part of downtown Savannah is a National Historic Landmark District. That means the federal government considers it significant to the country's history. And a recent study recommends listing the district as threatened, sort of like an endangered species. The biggest threats? Development that's too big and erosion of Oglethorpe's plan.
I think Savannah is a victim of its own success.
Ellen Harris directs historic preservation for Savannah's Metropolitan Planning Commission.
Because we have so many tourists, we need to have facilities to accommodate them. And then that leads to, you know, new hotels and larger hotels. And I'm not just picking on hotels. We have other large scale developments.
But hotels are some of the most visible new projects in that area. More than a dozen are in some stage of planning or construction, according to the new report. And there's a paradox here.
What's the paradox?
Well, it's this sort of complicated web where the historic district is part of what is so appealing about Savannah. It's why tourists come here. It's what draws developers who cater to those tourists with hotels and things like that. It's what draws residents who visit and say, oh, my gosh, I want to move here. I want to live in Savannah. You know, it's this incredibly charming and unique place. But then what often happens is a developer goes to build a hotel or somebody buys a house and they move in and, you know, they want to make some changes. They want to alter the house a little bit. The developer wants to put an extra story on the hotel or things like that. And it's those exact little changes are a big part of what the Park Service says, you know, are bit by bit chipping away at the historic integrity. That's what brought these people here in the first place. And in the case of the developers and actually homeowners too, there's also historic preservation tax credits that are another thing that draw people to Savannah because you can get a tax credit that helps incentivize, you know, restoring a historic building instead of just building something new. But again, if you start making little allowances that let people change things, that let people chip away at this district, this incredibly unique thing we have here in Savannah, it can create a problem in the long run.
So how about the process of reporting the story? At the beginning of that little clip, we heard from a walking tour in Savannah. I'm guessing you had to get out in the field quite a bit for this one.
Yeah, I you only heard a little bit of the tour, but it was a 3-hour tour that I actually went around with, which was really fascinating and illuminating for me. I've lived in Savannah for years now, and I walk around downtown every day. But it was great to really get that historic and very specific perspective in this tour guide. And this was part of why I went on the tour with her was, you know, she's able to point out all kinds of little tiny examples you don't even necessarily notice walking around, both of places where somebody has built something that messes with the famous Oglethorpe plan or that changes the street a little bit, and also some places where new construction has actually really worked hard to adapt to Savannah's plan and how that has worked in some places and, you know, could potentially continue to work in the future if more people follow that kind of model.
Well, especially when you're talking about urban planning or about historic designations, oftentimes you're in a place where people really pay attention to that kind of thing, or you are surfacing a story that people didn't know about. What was going on around this in Savannah at that time?
I would say a little bit of both. I won't take credit for surfacing this story. I mean, historic preservation for some people in Savannah is always top of mind. When the report came down that made this recommendation, it really ignited a lot of concern and a lot of pushback. I mean, there's always concern, and there's always a segment of people in Savannah who are fighting for historic preservation. But when this report came out, there was a huge public response. People really were worried because This is a big deal. I mean, history and the historic landmark district is such an important part of so much of Savannah. I mean, it's not just why so many of us love living here. It's, again, a big part of what helps drive our tourism industry. So there was a lot of concern and a lot of people kind of loudly raising the alarm and saying, we need to fix this. Regardless of what the Park Service does, you know, this is an issue this city needs to address.
So I should have asked you this right as soon as we heard the clip, but what came of the recommendation from the National Park Service?
Well, yeah, the Park Service ended up following the recommendation. So back in the summer, they did, in fact, designate the district as threatened, which, again, does not mean that it's not that it's, you know, not a landmark district anymore, but it is now considered threatened, which means it's in danger of, you know, being eroded, being damaged from all kinds of things. I've mentioned development, but it's not just development. It's also natural disasters and some more intangible things, just like traffic and noise. But yeah, we are now considered a threatened National Historic Landmark District.
That's GPB's Emily Jones. Also with us, Ricky Bevington. She is host of All Things Considered for GPB, and Ross Terrell, who's a reporter. So natural disasters, that's your pickup, Ross. This is one of the stories that you followed this year, going to Southwest Georgia in the aftermath of Hurricane Michael. First of all, like, overall impressions, what was that like?
It was a really unique experience. I think being here in Atlanta, sometimes you get caught up in a vision of Georgia that isn't. And more of the state is like Southwest Georgia, the spread out kind of rural community than Atlanta. So it was really surreal to realize an actual Category 3 hurricane hit the state of Georgia.
Well, here's one of the folks that you spoke with amid all the hurricane recovery efforts.
Tina Owens lives in the camper a few miles north of downtown Bainbridge. In the first 14 days since Michael, she has only been able to take 3 showers.
It's devastation. It's heartbreak. It's miserable. You can't take a bath. You can't wash clothes. You can't wash dishes. You can't get anywhere, you know?
Owen says the day after the storm, she just sat and cried. Then she spent the next few days picking up limbs and debris around her home. She sat outside her camper talking to Robert Johnson, a new friend she made in the aftermath of Michael. Owen says after she dealt with her emotions, she realized community would be the key to starting over.
He lost his house, and I told him he could come here. I've gotten to know my neighbors that I didn't even know. You know, we've banded together and helped each other.
Russ, what was going on there?
There I was talking to a woman named Tina Owens, and she lived in a trailer and had just met a neighbor because of the hurricane who lost power. And you just saw a community kind of come together to rebuild, to start to pick up the pieces. And she was just expressing the other destruction she faced. She hadn't been able to, or she showered only 3 times in the span of 2 weeks. No power, hard to get out and get food. And it was really a stark contrast to how I thought it looked after a hurricane.
Well, covering disasters, of course, is part of the news here. But what was your favorite feature thing that you did this year?
Yeah, I think it was covering the Gwinnett girls flag football team. The county had just started an all-girls flag football league sponsored by the Falcons. And so I got to go out and watch one of their practices and talk to some of the players and coaches. And I had a lot of fun doing that.
Here's a few people that you spoke to for this story.
I went out to watch them practice a few days before their first game. Their assistant head coach, Brett Wilson, says a lack of experience for girls playing football shouldn't hurt them.
Every girl out here is athletic, and a couple of them might not have grown up necessarily playing football with their big brothers every week, but they understand, you know, running, throwing, catching.
Each high school in Gwinnett will have a team. They'll play 12 games this season before a tournament-style playoff. Interest in joining the Wildcats went well beyond the 20 roster spots. Coach Wilson said that led to some tough cuts, even in their first season.
I got about 70 girls that want to play, but I don't have enough spots.
While spots on the team may be limited, the effect of the league goes beyond the girls on the field. Kimberly Mankin coaches at Collins Hill High School. She says besides the X's and O's of the game, this points to a larger narrative. Equality.
We always tell our kids the sky's the limit, but then we put limits on them when girls can't play guys football, so I think this is huge.
Mankin says this is an opportunity for girls to show their skills on the field in an organized format just like boys. There are refs, there are rules, and they want to win.
Ross, how'd the first season go? Is the league looking to expand girls football next year?
Yes. So every high school in Gwinnett has a team, and the next goal is now expanding this across the state. Gwinnett is the state's largest school district, so you have a lot of volume, a lot of people who can play. But now the goal is to take this to rural areas, to kind of move it out for metro Atlanta and hopefully have leagues across the state.
So we've been talking about things that are less timely, the kind of feature things. I mean, everybody here is, you know, you're hosting a show, you're filing stories all the time. The days are whizzing by. Are there any stories that stick with you in your mind that you would like to just circle back around and see how things are going?
Yeah, when you talk about the hurricane story, I mean, that was a tragic moment for a lot of people. So just to look back in and see how they were covering how these disaster relief efforts, if they really worked, and even following up on the flag football, is this successful in other parts of the state? And have we found a new kind of new sport? Will it take off like the Atlanta United?
And also, I mean, to piggyback on what Ross said about the hurricane recovery in Southwest Georgia, I mean, here on the coast, that hurricane didn't hit us as badly, but we did get 2 storms over the last previous 2 years. And so we're always eyeing, you know, sea level rise and climate change preparedness for the next big storm. So that's kind of a persistent story that we're always coming back to in Savannah and on the Georgia coast, is just how are we getting ready for at this point feels like the inevitable next hurricane.
And I will throw in there that what I'll be following up on is if any Georgia musicians name a Georgia place in any song in early 2019, I'm going to be doing a story about that place. So y'all let me know if you hear one.
Emily Jones, Ricky Bevington, and Ross Terrell, all from the GPB newsroom here in Around the State. And to hear their favorite features in their full expression, you can visit gpbnews.org. And that is it for our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and the Raven Taylor. Alec Kaslow is our engineer. Special thanks to Don Smith and his keen listening skills. And Amy Kiley is our senior producer. Our theme song is by Alex Crispin and Marshall Ruffin. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. This is On Second Thought.